left is, I'm from Anchorage, and on my left is my colleague, Representative Britt Euling from Anchorage, in fact, from the part of Anchorage I am from. And on my right is Representative Neil Caponin of Fairbanks. Representative Tischer, who chairs the House Health, Education, Social Services Committee, indicated that she had a scheduling conflict, which she regrets, and well, this is a joint session, but I will proceed in her absence. I remember that in 1983, members of the council came before us and also encountered a similar problem of non-appearing representatives and senators, and you must think, since you were in the same position in 1984, that there is something amiss here, and before you check your deodorants, let me say, it has nothing to do with you. I just left a meeting, two meetings. One was with the Consul of People's Republic of China, who was visiting legislators today, and the other was of the Anchorage delegation, which is at work right now preparing our capital projects for the capital budget for 1984. So the timing question is really the significant question here, and we cannot ever anticipate what the situation will be, and I apologize for my colleagues who may not be here. Some will be in and out, and you can be sure we will try to educate them as to what your interests have been. I understand that we will be hearing principally about three matters: the long-range goals for the handicapped and new state plan, for which there are regional versions that you will be describing, the issue of the Harborview facility and the appropriateness of placement, family contact, and proximity to home community transition to community living services for the handicapped. And we have heard much about that in our districts before coming to Juneau. And then thirdly, the impact of House Bill 194 relating to special education services. Senator Paul Fisher from the Kenai Peninsula in South Anchorage is in the room, and he is a member of the HESS committee, and I welcome him. We'll call people in the order. The other limitation is that I know I have to leave the building at 4:30 to catch a flight. Some of you may be in the same position, so I'll ask each witness to consider those time constraints in testifying. Carolyn, good afternoon.
Nice to meet you, Mr. Chairman. What we're going to do is do like two people at once.
Fine.
My name is Caroline Wolf, and this year I am the chair for the Governor's Council on the Handicapped and Gifted. And my home is in Barrow, where I'm the infant learning teacher. And I'm the therapist for the seven villages on the North Slope, so I itinerate to them.
Okay, I am Troy Davenport from Fairbanks, and I was born deaf, in a family of seven children who were also deaf, and I was previously a teacher with the Adult Learning Center in Fairbanks. Okay, I've just recently been appointed to the council. Okay, this is my interpreter, Tracy Jones. She's from the interpreter referral line. Okay, I would like to go ahead and take some quotes to give you some background about our council. Okay, this is from section, from 47, 80, 90. Okay, that says that our responsibilities are to, first of all, advocate the needs of handicapped and gifted persons before the executive and the legislative branches of the state government, and also for the public. Okay, the second thing that we are to do is to advise the executive and legislative branches of the state government and also the private sector of the programs, priorities, and specific things related to providing services to handicapped and gifted persons and also their families. Okay, also, the third one is to give the priorities and the specifications for the use of funds received by the state under public laws 91-117, and also under public law 94-103. general agency who plans and coordinates with the agencies through the Department of Health and Social Services, and through the Department of Education, and also through the departments that give direct services to persons who are handicapped and gifted. The 18 of us who are appointed members of the council were appointed by the governor. The 10 of us are direct consumers of services, such as myself. I am a person with a handicap or with some type of disability. Also, parent representatives are on the council. 8 of us are representatives of principal state agencies who do provide direct services to the public. Okay, we also have representatives from private and local services who provide service programs and are professionals in those fields. There are 6 priorities of these listed here. Okay, the first one is infant learning programs. The second is a daycare and respite program. The third one is a personal aid and attendant type care. The fourth is home maker services. 5th, community living services. And 6th one is for special education for gifted students.
These priorities.
Let me say that Representative Davis of Fairbanks and Representative Martin of Anchorage have joined us.
These priorities are based on the Alaska State Service Plan. This is a full copy, and we've tried to get around and given you your individual copies for your region, and those of you who haven't had them, we have them today for you. This is mandated by the federal law, and it sets up a 3-year projection of needs. And we have taken what we consider our priorities for the Governor's Council to push ahead. It's not necessarily 1, 2, 3, 4. These are the 6 needs together that we would like to see action on during the second session. And so what we'd like to do is acquaint you one by one with these at this time. The infant learning program was developed as an early detection and prevention program for individuals under the suspect of having extraordinary needs physically, mentally, or emotionally under the age of 3. The therapist goes into the infant's home and works with the entire family so that the infant's environment can be altered. The council would like to congratulate the legislature for their fine support and their financial support. Yet there are many regions still not receiving services. The LEU chain, the Toke and Glen Allen area, the Cordova, Valdez, and Yakutat area. There are no programs there, and there are over 100 infants in programs that are established and in these areas that have been identified and that are receiving either inadequate services or no services at all. Therefore, we would like to ask the legislature to put an additional $423,000 into this area so that we would have an infant learning program that would truly be network-wide, statewide.
The $423,000, my name's John Dowell, I'm from Kodiak, and I'm a parent of a 7-year-old Down syndrome child. The $423,000 is felt that would bring the state up into 100% services for the infants ages 1 through 3, or 0 through 3, excuse me. I was fortunate enough that when my daughter was born that the people from the state indicated that there was a possibility of such a program to be formed in Kodiak, and my wife and I, along with another couple, became involved in that, and they got the program going in Kodiak. I feel that it's the reason for that program's existence is the reason for my daughter's success. She's now in first grade, attending a normal first grade class. She does get some resource help, but she is not sitting in a full day of self-contained classroom like many students that maybe didn't have that opportunity. And I'd like to thank the legislature and the state for that chance of my daughter has. I think it's been made the difference in the world of our life for her.
Thank you, John. It's one of the satisfactions we have in this job to hear stories like that.
We do appreciate it.
Good afternoon. My name is Marion Endicott. I'm appointed to the Governor's Council for Handicapped and Gifted as a secondary consumer, which means that I'm the parent of a profoundly handicapped child. I'm going to speak to you with regard to the daycare and respite priority that the council has. Respite, for those of you who are not familiar with the term, is provided for care to a disabled family member that just requires occasional relief. It's not a babysitting service. It's that when people started talking about deinstitutionalizing children and trying to keep them in an in-home setting, they knew that there were going to be pressures if the 24-hour, 7-day a week, all the time kind of care was placed on the family structure. So the idea of a respite program evolved. The first one in the state happened to be with St. Jude Center in Juneau, Alaska. The funding shortfalls with respite, and it seems to have been just over the last several years that we get one or two programs in major areas of the state, Anchorage and Fairbanks specifically, and they've been subjected to some massive cuts with a big struggle to get that funding put back intact before the budget actually passes. And again, they are faced with that having been done a little bit at the departmental level and very likely to continue. So council is proposing that over the 84 recommended funding level, proposed increase of $152,200, as well as the complete reinstatement and assurance that those respite funds that were provided last year will continue through to bring up what we feel is adequate to provide to those underserved and unserved areas for respite care programs.
Well, can you tell me, Mary, how the council's proposal differs from Governor Sheffield's budget? Do you have that?
It would appear that the recommended funding increase and 85, from what I have in front of me, it doesn't appear that there is any difference over the governor's budget. Oh, excuse me. The governor's proposed recommended level is at $889,400. And we're requesting that be brought to $1,041.6, so that it's reinstating $152,200 over the governor's budget.
Yeah, I'm Michael Rose. I'm from Anchorage. I was originally from Kenai, but we emigrated to Anchorage. And I'm here as a parent to talk about my son, Matthew, who is multiply handicapped, and tell you a little bit about my wife and I using that service. Because of respite, both of us work. Because of respite, we were allowed to get out together, and the respite worker could come to our home and take care of Matthew. Matt, because he's multiply handicapped, has a mental age of approximately 20 months or so, and yet he has a 7-year-old body, and so it's pretty difficult for a young babysitter to handle his needs, and the respite worker was able to take care of his problems, so it was very useful to us. We feel very strongly that it has really helped our marriage and helped preserve the integrity of our family, and I think I'm probably one parent among dozens, perhaps hundreds, perhaps thousands in the state who's benefited by respite. So we'd like to urge you to consider funding respite to the max, you know, from two perspectives. One, from a compassion perspective, that it would help preserve the integrity of the family and the couples, serve as a buffer so we can continue to provide for our children. That's what we want to do. Secondly, from a fiscal responsibility perspective, in the long term, if it serves as a buffer, it'll deter institutionalization and prevent the state from spending large amounts of money once, you know, if they have to go to Harbor View or some other institution. We as parents simply want to be able to take care of our own, and respite will help us do that without, you know, while they're still in our home, without them being taken out. Thank you.
Chair, just a comment. I really share what you're saying because of a personal experience. Mr. Chairman, in 1975-76, there was no program that I was aware of in the state. At that time, Mr. Chairman, we had 9 children, 1 severely handicapped. Boy, would it really help if we did have a program like that. So I share your concern.
Thanks.
For any of you that came in later on, there are some sheets here in the chamber I'd like to pass you around that has suggested budgets. I want to talk to you about personal aid and attendant care. And for those of you that don't know what it provides for intensive and individualized personal care at home. And it was originally set up in 1982 through Independent Options Now. The money that was used provided for barrier-free housing, transportation, and training for the aides that were going to people. In 1982, it provided help for 8 people. Last year, when we went through the funding process, we came in looking at the cut, and through works by the legislature and through people working together, the money was totally put back in, so the Anchorage program couldn't keep going at the level of $330,000. In 1983, they served 15 people, so they did pick up people this money. It provides a great savings to the state. You're looking at $38,000, the person's in a nursing home, as opposed to $21,900 being taken care of by an attendant. And the savings is $16,100 per year per person. This year, the Governor's Council is recommending that there be a $300,000 increase, which would provide enough money so that 15 more severely handicapped people in the state can be served. And basically, the people that we're looking at are young people that are mentally alert, but they're severely handicapped. And they're sitting in nursing homes because there's no place else for them. But if they have a tenant, they can get out, they can go to school, they can even work.
Let me ask you a question. I noticed that in all of these categories, the council is recommending higher figures than the administration. And I respect and I understand the budgetary constraints that the governor feels obliged to take into account. But in the budget-making process, what is the interaction between the council and the administration? I mean, did you get an opportunity to sit down with the Office of Budget Management and the governor's advisors and the commissioner and say, before you go to the legislature with the 85 FY budget, these are where we think, as your council governor, you should be coming down?
We strongly believe in what you're saying, and we have tried and we will continue to try.
But you did not have
did
not have that kind of access in the interim in 83.
Yeah. I'm also going to be talking about the homemaker service. I don't know if you're
But it would seem to me, this isn't megalomania, but I think I would want to get this advice privately beforehand and take that into account rather than have it first brought to light after I've made my budget and have it publicly presented. But everybody's different, I guess. Okay.
The homemaker service provides for household assistance, chores like chopping wood, washing dishes, helping pay with the bills, helping take care of the kids. What it does is it allows a person to live at home, and used by both elderly and by handicapped people. In fact, at this point in time, it's used by more elderly than it is by handicapped people. What it is it's a preventative. It keeps people out of institutions, especially the old. It allows them to live at home. So you're saving the money there because you're not putting your money into institutions. The way it's set up now, it provides 20 hours of service for anyone who qualifies for the program. And that's where we're running into problems. There are not enough hours to go around for the people that need help from the handicaps that usually need more hours than, say, the 20 hours. Plus, there's just not enough hours, period. In 1983, 1,150 people were served, with 50 of those people being handicapped. You're paying $13.66 an hour for the 8 service. Being used to help these people. At this point, it's estimated that there are 250 handicapped people additionally that could be served in the state.
You're talking then about more than doubling the program?
The homemaker service?
How many? No,
what do you mean?
Personal aid or the homemaker?
Okay, personal aid, I'm talking about doubling.
Personal aid, you're talking about.
Okay, and as far as the homemaker service, we're asking for an increase over the proposed budget of $175,000, which would provide more training for the aides that are working with the disabled and would also allow for more hours for homemakers to work. And also at this time, only about half the Alaska communities are served. And part of that has to do with the wages and that it's hard to get homemakers out in the bush because they can get so much money doing something else.
Representative, yes, thank you, Senator. What particular areas are really, in your opinion, deficient as far as the statewide needs are concerned?
The homemaker service? The bush areas.
The bush areas. So you feel that the urban areas are pretty well covered, and it's mainly getting out.
Can I give
people
this to somebody
are shaking
else
their heads behind me. I see some shaking of the head, so behind you.
The bush areas, for the most part, what happens is you get the urban areas, and then what's left over gets skimmed off. You go up to the next largest area, it gets skimmed off, you go to the next largest area. So by the time you go to, like, Oshkosh up or Wixit, you don't have any time left. You know, Barrow might have a few hours, and Fairbanks has more. So the problem, you know, depending, if you need this, the problem is really big, no matter whether you're in Fairbanks or in Oshkosh.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then also a follow-up question on that. Is your cost actually a little bit higher out there? I know you said something about $13 an hour.
No, it's...
Well, the problem is that... In a village, say, you can get $25 an hour to hammer, and why would you get $13 an hour to do a lot more work and to be, you know, more involved? Plus the idea that you only can get, like, 6 hours a week or 8 hours a week, then it doesn't make sense for you to turn down a full-time job for $13.
So, I was talking to the head of Oak Rehab here in Jill this afternoon and came to one of our meetings. For example, he has a young man now that needs the service, but he can't get enough hours so that the young man can, you know, stay out of having to be put in an institutionalized type of care.
Mr. Cohen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the personal aid, you said there was an estimate of 200 additional people. How did you arrive at the estimate? I mean, I know it's a needed program. My friends who are paraplegic who have this program, but how do you arrive at an estimate to meet the need to go for the program expansion?
Okay, you said 200, right?
Now you told us that you estimate that there are 200 more people
okay.
who require personal aid and attendant care.
No, that's the homemaker program.
Oh, okay.
I did the two programs back to back. I'm sorry, I forgot to.
Okay. Well, Representative Martin has a question, but before I go back, so let me just take the liberty here. following Representative Capone, when you say this is what we need to have a full service, meet full service needs, how does that compare? I could go back to your 1983 report, I suppose, and reconstruct this, but how does that compare with what you told us would be a full service program in 83? You know what I mean? I'm wondering...
I know guess, what you're getting at.
I'm wondering whether, and this is what is, I think, behind some of these questions, whether the council's figures are... assumptions or are based on surveys or what kind of increment they represent over what you were asking for in the last budget year.
Okay, a lot of the data that we work with we get from the actual institutions and we get from the wait list and lots of people all over the state on wait list. And that's what makes up for, you know, what we figure out what we need. If you notice, there is a difference between what we meet the 100% and what we're suggesting that you add. We're not asking for the 100%, we're just saying, could you give us this much more? There is a big difference. If we got enough money to cover all that we needed within the state to bring up community services to right now to where our wait lists are, we would need $3.5 to $4 million to do it.
So, and the total cost of all these, do you know what the total increment would be if we adopted all of the proposals?
I haven't added it.
Okay, well, you can do that. Let me recognize Terry Martin, Representative
from America. Thank you. A couple of terminology that sometimes you say bush communities, and sometimes you say native communities, and sometimes you say rural. When I'm thinking of anything in an urban area, I say rural. Sometimes people say bush, and they really mean native, which to me is derogative. But, when you say bush, does that mean the other rural areas? That same statement you mentioned, have only served half the communities in the state, and have listed communities 235. And would you expect us to have someone available in every community? Some of them may not need it, all may not need it, other Delta may not need it. So when we're talking about that we should serve every community, we should clarify what we mean.
First of all, the state plan has derived the information from multi-sources, and that is what we base our presentation today on in these figures. And our figures are based on last year's figures with differentials due to inflation. What we're suggesting is that if a villager needs help and could stay in the village if they could get homemaker services, then that service should be provided there. There's four levels of communities as outlined in the state plan, and what we're suggesting is that your biggest communities like Anchorage and Fairbanks have a whole system of services provided. And as you break down to smaller communities, itinerant services be available or services be available as needed. But the availability, even if the need is there, is not.
Not even in the itinerant area, like in a nursing program and all sort of things. Each seal used to do it when they had an itinerant program to take care of needy people. But you say even at that one, we know nurses at every village in the state, not whether at every oil community.
Right. What we're saying is that places like Fairbanks have some programs going, but there's not enough hours available. And it's like somebody could stay in the home provided they could get maybe 17 or 20 hours a week. In the villages, we almost have a second problem in as much as you're competing for people to want the job, period. And so there's two kinds of problems. But mostly, we just don't have enough hours available to people.
I'm Todd Risley. I'm a professor at the University of Alaska at Anchorage and a member of the Governor's Council.
Talking about
community services.
I'm Susan Pitts, and I have a disability called dystonia, which is a condition that causes my muscles to tighten up. And I got this when I was 11 years old. I've been in Anchorage about 8 years now. The thing that strikes me primarily is, well, the attitude and the awareness level that exists up here. People just don't seem to want to acknowledge that handicaps can happen up here in Alaska. If I'm stuttering and my speech isn't coming out as clearly as I'd like it to. But what Debbie just mentioned before, if we did have a proper attendant here and homemaker services and modifications in the housing, we could have a lot of people outside of institutions and living at home. And transportation to get to our employment so that we can pay our rent and pay for our attendant services. Now, I know that there are lots of people in the West who have handicaps, but I don't see them. I don't see them in the stores. I don't see them in school. I mean, it is hard to get around. Transportation in the factory is hard to get around. And once you do get around, then the attitudes are such that they push you back into your house or wherever. Yes. I think that people feel so handicap, that they're so afraid of handicap. They're so afraid that it could happen to them. That they choose, that we all choose to be ignorant about it. And then when ignorant, that brings on more fear, because people are always frightened about things that they don't know about. And it just goes around in that cycle. don't shut us off and go back, and it's not going to go away. As you kept keeping more friends and people from the living room, and more babies are being saved, there's going to be triple the handicap population in the next 10 years. Because it's something that it's something that's there. You can build for those, and the roads are going to, you can see them, you can handle that problem. That's a tangible. A road is tangible. A house is tangible. This may not be so tangible to you because it hasn't hit home yet. But if you live long enough, it will. I just wish that it was a more comfortable subject to discuss.
I think your being here makes it is a step towards that. I appreciate your statement. I didn't mean to interrupt you either, but I think that your willingness to come to Juneau and share that is very helpful.
Let me point out that what we're talking about, of course, it involves not just physically different development of the disabled, also they're part of us, a predictable proportion of every birth, of every 100 births. What we're trying to do in the statement land is to say we want to prevent excluding those people from their homes and from society. In effect, we're talking about a continuum of services. If we look at residential services in general, we can say your own home. Everybody starts off there. Every baby is born and starts off with their parents in a home. 25 years ago, in this state and other states, when the parents got desperate, there wasn't special ed, there wasn't any early intervention, there wasn't anything, they went to an institution all the way at the bottom of a continuum of services, if we look at the continuum from your own home to a very restrictive large institution. What we're trying to emphasize in the state plan is not we need availability of services in between. We need specialized foster care, we need group homes, we need things that are in between so the person doesn't have to be, not only go into dimensions of restrictiveness, but movement away from home. If an adult retarded person goes through the school, in effect, they can be, if we have the support services, some of which we've talked about, they can stay in the home. The pressures are removed somewhat from the parents, so they can stay in the home longer. We have school systems. But what we don't have is, again, movement. As soon as they have to leave home, no parent is expected to have their child in their home for the rest of their lives. Okay, the school is over. They go through 12 years of school, in effect. Now what we have is the next level of services that we have are only concentrated in very few spots, Anchorage and so on. And we don't have a range of those. The other problem we've got right now is that all of those places are full, are absolutely full. We don't have an empty bed, a residential bed in the place. We just did a study at Harvard looking at the clients there, asking, we were asking a set of questions. But you realize that right now, there are no young people at Harvard. They're all in their late 20s and 30s. They're the era of the baby that we paid them, the outside institutions back again, and so on. They were the people who grew up and entered the system as children in Alaska when we didn't have some of these programs. Okay. The exception we have is there's a 12-year-old person at Harvard View who came in just a few months ago. That person came in because every place in the state was full. There was a crisis in the family. Something had to be done. And the only empty bed in the state for that 12-year-old person who'd been living at home, was at Harvard. We're reaching right now a peak of a crisis in residential services. It's been obscured because there have been battles about it shouldn't be Harvard View, it should be community placement. We promote community placement, but right now we have to face the issue. There are no residential places anymore. They're filled up, and they filled up last year. We're asking for an increase in $583,700 right now. I think what you'll find, you'll hear a little more about that because I think everybody realizes, including the governor at this point,
we're absolutely full, and the pressure is immediately right there.
So the issue isn't whether, by the way, let me introduce Speaker of the House, Joe Hayes, whose aide has been here throughout. He's joined us, we appreciate that. And Senator Dick Fisher, member of the Senate Committee, whose aide has been here throughout. But what you're saying, I think, is that the Harbor View question, in a way, is moot because we can't put more people in the track.
We don't, I mean, if we had money to build 85 community beds, placements, they would be filled the day we built them by community people who have never been in an institution. Because the wait list, the known wait list is that long, of verified places where are just trying to hold out for that little next spot at Hope Cottages or wherever.
Okay. Doctor, I'd like to call in Representative Martin and Mr. Capone.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate you coming down. You're quite right that the average citizen, including myself, does feel quite uncomfortable when you meet a handicapped person. And often I've analyzed, well, why not feel this way? But now, since I've opened my mind in the last 5 years, I have developed a lot of handicapped friends. And now it's all almost returned to 180 degrees that now I feel inferior that these people with these handicapped are doing the things they're doing. It just broke my mind. So now I have to pretend to be a great optimist that there's no limitations once you give them freedom. But we do have our limitations in the sense that maybe our priorities are not going in the directions that they should be, and I think our priorities will open up as our attitude, as more people learn that the only handicap a person has is the society around it, as I feel now. And I've had some friends in the last couple of weeks that written me letters who have handicapped young adults beyond that age, and they have the problem that, you know, suddenly something should happen to them. They want to feel comfortable. There's an alternative. They're at their own homes. But two of them live in the Mountain View, one from Anchorage, and they're living there by themselves. And I'm amazed how the individual male gets on the bus every day and goes from Mountain View all the way to South Anchorage to work in the grocery store. Just because my mother, you know, when alternative living will be the answer. And as Senator Joe said, and I think the doctor said too, that sometimes with reports we're getting to legislators that people, the group who should be unified in their efforts are making decisions that are this way or that way. And I feel that we need balance, we need Harbor View. I went down there at 65, right after the earthquake, and I remember a lot of children. So I can see your problem if we're not rotating children, what's happening to children groups there year after year. But if we have an alternative, I've seen it too much in my area, and if I cross the street from the training center, I'm absolutely amazed what they're doing there, and I feel with your problem that we do need certain projects, apartments, whatever, handicapped people can work with each other. In that line, I haven't heard anything as to what your recommendations are in CIPs. 2 years ago, handicapped people had two diverse opinions of what they want in alternative living. Have you consolidated efforts now?
See, you've touched on something really important, because I think we live in a culture that emphasizes the physical perfection, and it's so ingrown in the advertising and commercial media that to educate people, to encourage participation in all community activities of handicapped people is countercultural in a certain sense, I suppose, and maybe it's something that you help sensitize us to. I'm sure you can. You feel that too? Watch your television, you'll be here back. You're on television now.
The more acceptable handicaps that you see, the more attractive handicaps, those too.
Cottage. They're not going to see.
Representative Capone.
Thank you. All right. I was thinking that, you know, 25 years ago, we didn't have any effect last year of territorial stud. We had no means of taking care of handicapped people, and what churches or volunteer groups or parents themselves undertook, the territory didn't have the finances for it. There was some federal money, but the groups, I can remember, Fairbanks Faith location and some of the others, and the school system put out a great deal of effort with very little money. I don't think we ever did go through the sort of monumental institution building that characterized it in the continental United States. But I think you're true that parents and families did tend to lock away handicapped children or members of the family in the back room, although in towns were much smaller then, and of course it was a different kind of situation even then. Variable thing. I mean, I don't think Fairbanks is a town of 3,000 mostly mining town. Everybody knew everybody else. But obviously, you know, I mean, when you had mud streets and wooden sidewalks, there were real impediments to the poor handicapped people. Some of the people I worked with, even in the mines, were handicapped. I mean, it's a variable thing. There's no one image that fits. I don't mean to say that we have any greater or lesser commitment to loan that'll pay off very well. Ada wants to do something else. The council doesn't have enough money. It never gets through the budget. But a lot of people, including handicapped people themselves, have, like yourself, have been working on it. I don't think there's any, you know, final solution. It's a continual thing in process because it's always changing, and we have to be conscious of that and keep trying to work on it, but never assume that we're going to complete the answer.
Representative, thank you, Senator. Along the lines of perhaps what Representative Martin mentioned, along the idea of residential care, I had the opportunity during the interim period to tour some of the residential care facilities and see how it really benefit in the community and over the institutional kind of a situation. I think it's an area we really need to take some concern over and work in that direction. What is your feeling as far as trying to meet the need as far as residential care in the home or wherever? What are we really going to have to do to move in that direction to create that?
I think our job right now, we're trying to wrestle with a recommendation for some people that says what could be, you know, how much of the need could be reasonably met in 1 year. And that's going to be a small portion. In other words, the growth capabilities, we're so far behind. This amount is way too low. It's just kind of the estimation of, you know, this is probably reasonable ask for based on some younger services and expansions. We don't want, in other words, the long range plan says these kind of services have to be added to places they don't exist now. Want to keep people near their families. So even if they have to live, they're living in a group home, they're living in a group home, not in Anchorage if they come from Kotzebue. They're living in a group home in Kotzebue, or, you know, in other words, they're living in a group home in an area, in a sense, where their families can visit, they're still members of the community. It doesn't cost that much more to do that. See, but right now, we're way behind, and I think this would be a minimum figure. We may be, maybe a larger figure actually coming.
Yeah. Good point. Sort of a follow-up statement. I had the opportunity, also a constituent of mine had some real problems. He's lived in the Fairview area, but was from one of the Bush areas. And I finally realized what a transitional period you had to go through to adjust from that kind of a cultural situation into an urban setting. And it took a matter of years to do that. So I really can key into the importance of keeping it within the area. Thank you.
Representative Peter Gall,
excuse me, Senator Paul Fisher.
One thing, I really relate with the gal because I think society itself really is at fault. I know we had our problem with our son. People, because they're different, look at you as though there's a stigma there. here's somebody that's in a wheelchair, somebody that can't control their muscles or whatever. No, but what I'm agreeing with you, and I'm saying somewhere we have to have folks look at us all, and we're all individual people. And I really said that I would do. But what I don't hear is shelter workshops, for example. I think there's a tremendous need for these in the state of Alaska, and I don't even know if there is any, maybe one in Anchorage. One thing I would say, I would hope that everybody here gets a chance sometime in your life to work with Special Olympics. I think that's one of the most marvelous things. I had a chance two years in a row.
John and Karen, you're going to wind up this part of the
I guess we're going to kind of switch 180 degrees here a little bit. One of the things the council also is supposed to advocate for is for gifted children in the state of Alaska. I don't want to, first of all, I want to set the record straight that we're not here asking for money for special education in the school district. If you remember 2 years ago, I believe it was, we passed a Senate Bill 3, which increased that by about $23 million, roughly doubling the special education funds from the state of Alaska. We're not here asking for that. We're extremely appreciative of that money then. What we are looking at, though, on the for the gifted community is an honors institute. We had one back in 1980. We run at the University of Alaska during the summertime. We run by DOE, and they invited districts around the state to send students up. It was very well received. Everybody was very excited about it. And we feel that that was a very viable use of $100,000. And we'd like to see that reinstituted along with that in that same frame. One of the things we feel is needed in the state is some technical assistance for the individual school districts at the state level where they can come to somebody and get some help and get their education. It's still a fairly new field for almost everybody in the state. And I think if you talk to many educators or many special ed directors, you'll find that's something they're really wrestling with in their school district. It's pretty easy to look at a kid and say, you can't read. You need some special help in reading. What do you do with a kid that's got a high IQ that's more ready to drop out of school because you aren't meeting his needs? We need something that's innovative in that area. And so what we'd like to see done, what this legislature did back in, I think it was about 1979 or 80, fund a full-time position at the State Department of Education for a gifted person in the department or in the division of special services. That position since then has been watered down. It's now about a one-third time position. I understand that, everybody's had cuts and you get the personnel where you can. And I think that's what's happened to the Department of Education. They needed somebody that could also do some things for the special education handicap in that area. And they've taken some of that time. We would really like to see that position come back up to full-time funding. And that's looking at approximately $76,000 price tag for that person to come on board and to do the traveling that would be necessary and so forth. The third thing of gifted and talented education is 2 years ago the legislature gave this council some money to work on gifted education in the state of Alaska. We had a task force that came up with an attempt in the state of Alaska to draw together the gifted communities into an idea that if you're gifted in Fairbanks, you should be gifted in Anchorage. Some sort of a unified attempt to get a unified definition and then to get some sort of a program model out that everybody could adopt that would work. Instead of everybody going this way and that way trying to figure out something, maybe one model that would work and then institute that in the different districts. The council did finish with that and the funds are expended for that. There was a manual developed. The Department of Education now has it and they have put it out into districts. There have been some districts that volunteer and Chris, unless I'm understanding, eight districts that have volunteered to take that into their districts and work with it and try to get some information back to the Department of Education. There is some money needed so that there can be some follow-up done on that, and we're looking at approximately $75,000. We're asking for that much. So in the entire field of what gifted and talented special education, we're looking at $251, not to go to individual districts, but to go to the Department of Ed to help with technical assistance, the Honors Institute, and face the field testing of the gifted talent.
Representative Martin.
Yes, thank you, Senator Jeff.
You thought out that you're going 180 degrees from the problem we've been giving mostly, and the problem I think that needs much attention. As a person I taught in Oklahoma, and I've only worked with boys up here for 9 years in Anchorage Town, it seems to me we have to set priorities. And in the last 2 years, in working with the school chair and in the UAA, I see that the criteria is being changed so that major emphasis is being put on those students who have the hardest time. I've always had a problem with ex-teacher and principal always rating themselves on the excellent student they have in class. Now, if that seems acute for being a student, no matter who you put in front of seems acute, and why you should be rated, because the top students just end up in your class, and principal say, hey, you're doing excellent, look how many top students you got. But that poor guy that has the student that's a hard to work with, really needs dedicated efforts to meeting and training, and I get it at home. Just ironic is that the school itself may be at fault to place no emphasis in the wrong place. And in this case here, if you have an excellent student, usually you have parents behind that individual that are helping him or her, but the outside of the school program that have the abilities to help that individual to get in the extracurricular programs. And here again, when you see what we put into our student leadership program, money-wise, for these students who are going to excel anyway, compared to what we put into the program for those kids that aren't going to make it, or have a hard time making it, it's imbalanced. So I understand your concern, but I feel right now, we're not reaching, we're not even attempting to reach the students that really need the help, those extra hours on learning to read or spell and get confidence. And I'd have to tell you, in all honesty, that I'd still feel my priority. It's not necessarily always money, it's how you rate your teacher. How many kids did you get from a D category to a C, or C to a B? I'm not going to care about how many A students you have in the pocket.
I won't argue. It's, I'm a junior high teacher, and it's, like you say, at least the smart kid in the kids does well and cares about school, but then the tough kid is the kid that just can't do the material, there's no doubt about that. But I think that part of what the research is now showing is that we're finding that the A students are not necessarily the gifted students. The A students are the kid that's the high achiever that's working the rear end off to get that A. And we're finding that a lot of our gifted students are the C and some of the D and some of our F students. They don't care. Their needs are not being met. Just the kid that's put into an eighth grade class expected to read at the eighth grade level, who's actually functioning on a second grade level, he can't function there either.
It's a motivation that's missing.
They're part of
the growth on the teacher.
Part of it seems to be institutional. It isn't just the additional money. I know that, for example, students can be the writer students very often need to be freed up rather than given another program, another hurdle to get up the cost. And perhaps one of the we no longer have early entrance to university. I mean, Harvard will let a 13-year-old in, but the UAA will not. And free up the process of learning
DOE will not fund the full-time person within the department?
Right now, there's a slot that was the legislature funded. And I think it was about 1979. I don't have the exact date, but that's what I think it was. That position was filled back in that capacity until, I believe, last year. And at that time, the department felt that they needed, if I'm not mistaken, if Chris can correct me, somebody who could not only work in the gifted talent area, but could also go out and do audits in special education, or whatever it need be in the special education. So they took, you know, instead of designating it still a full-time special education position, because of the fact that they needed to do audits, and they found perhaps more cost-effective that, to take and send that person out and do that, that they have watered down the position until it's about, geez, and Chris, I think it's about one-third gifted talent to two-thirds special education.
That's based on the DOE's decision.
That's the end of our formal presentation, however, since we're here to advise you if you have any questions or ideas that we can help you with.
Thank you very much.
Let me ask for a little more elaboration, if I can, about the need for community living services in the Anchorage area. Can anyone talk to that or quantify it or talk? I think one of my colleagues asked in terms of the capital requirements you might have to organize those. We're getting some mail about this.
I think. A bit about the capital issues that Martin asked me about. By and large, the way that the services are generally delivered are they contract for, you know, a certain number of services, the state that is. And in a sense, the people that arrange the housing, I mean, the recipient program rents the house and leases them, something like that. There may be a needs for other things.
Is this with the Hope College? They have a new program going on for young adults.
The Hope College.
Just put a little bit of light on it. Todd gave me a figure of, I think, $589,000, and that's being re-reviewed right now.
Could you identify yourself?
As I'm Bob Gregovich. I'm the program administrator for developmental disabilities in the Department of Health and Social Services. And just briefly, we're re-reviewing with the governor's office at the present time the need for an increased enhancement of that program, including vocational services and respite care and a whole range of community programs. We're just recently formed a group to study the issue on a very conservative basis of the actual need, not with national statistics and not with our predictions for the future, but just the actual need that is on our waiting list at the present time. And verifying that list is quite a job. So during the next week, because of the time constraints of both the legislature and the executive branch, we're going to be getting our brains out of the coming up with a figure. We think it's a lot higher than $589,000. I think it's probably up in the $1 million category. But we're looking at it in terms of what could be accomplished next year in meeting that need in the community rather than what the total needed.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Gohan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So does that mean then that to the best of your current information, we can answer these letters we're receiving on Harbor View with an affirmative reply that you expect to maintain that facility?
Yeah, that's a different issue to bring up about the Harbor View facility.
Well, it's tied.
We're talking about.
It's related, though, isn't it?
Yes, well, that's right. And council is looking at that. In fact, we're developing Council of the Handicapped Gift, which I am on.
Maybe I'm not being clear. It seems to me that the questions that have been raised are a matter of priority issues. You know, are you going to address the in-home care? Are you going to address the small group home? Or are you going to address this your needs are going to be met, or is that something that we could correct?
See, we have such a problem both ways right now, and particularly the community maybe thought you could reinforce this or But we have the, we're locked in the community right now. There's no service availability. The pressure on the community system right now, putting blinders on it, or in fact, just factoring that out, is we feel very substantial in the $1 million categories. That's actual waiting list that, that we have available, and that's what's being verified presently. We're, that's sidestepping, if you will, the issue of harbor fuel for the presence of those needs right now.
Representative Lindauer has joined our Senator Fisher.
I hope it's, at least I think it should be somewhat clear that the issue somehow surfaced as though it's residential care versus harbor view. And it's, I don't know where people got that idea, as though that, well, you can just take money away from harbor view because it's so expensive and do it here. And when in reality, there's a need for both. And so somehow word got out that you can take from one for the others.
Let me interpret it, looking at these kind of issues in various other states. The reason that conflict occurred, as expressed that way, was the on the assumption there's no more money anyways. And so the issue of it costs $85,000 a year for harbor view, less than that of a community, it's the budget cap that presents that either or. What we're saying is every place is full. If you build 85 more beds in the community where you should be, to, in a sense, put the harbor view clients in, they would be filled up by people on the waiting list who are still living at home under precarious circumstances, who need that kind of care right away.
But just going along with the same line that, that I started, we cannot also make this assumption that you can just take from Harbor View and place the individual somewhere else, because in Harbor View they have 24-hour doctor care, et cetera, et cetera. So somewhere I get the input from the public as though this can all be done. I think we see that this
is I need to correct that. We've just done a study at Harbor View, looking at the cases, the clients, the level of service of each person there. Okay, to the best of our conservative estimates, there are two people at Harbor View. There are two people at Harvard View who need nursing level of care. By that I mean a level of care that would not be given by a mother to a child living at home. In other words, any nursing medical services. And would need more medical services than, in a sense, a mother and a child at home could get from their local physician. Okay? There are two people there. Only they are not a different population. They're different right now because they're older. They have been in the system. They never had any of this early. They never had early training, never had special ed. They've been institutionalized all their lives.
Well, you mean that if we had had an enlightened policy 25 years ago, we'd have two people in Harvard today.
We'd have two people in ICF nursing home care facilities. Like, you know, that's what the chart's here. Everybody's at values. If we had what we have today, there would be two people there. If we had many people concentrated in Anchorage and so on, if we had what the state, the governor's plan, council plan said, they would be spread out, in a sense, all over the state.
Representative Lindauer.
You know, I went out to the people here, because of this issue, I took it upon myself a few weeks ago, at my own expense, to my dad, fly down to Valdez. And I got to Valdez, and after I got to Valdez, I brought my experience also. I called up the director of the Harbor View. I said, I'm here, I'll be right over, no one expect. I spent the entire afternoon over there, and I went through everything, and I come to a couple of conclusions. In fact, I went to the editor and the newspaper, why I'm saying, hey, we can't do away with Harbor View, and they're doing a very good job in many things, in many ways, not in all ways, in many ways. There are people who require 24-hour service, and who require perhaps not trained medical service, but they need one or, in some cases, several aides on duty at a five. And these people, for better or for worse, seem to be going to Harvard. And what I received from all the staff members that I talked to was that the needs of the client, the increasingly the most distressed cases were there, and that they were, in fact, supportive of putting things in the community. But the answer is not to try to take chisel money out of one program and put it into another. With a growing population, the fact of life is we have to appropriate money, we have to
tell you that I have been a volunteer here at the group home in Juneau for the last year and a half, and I'm very familiar with the Juneau group home child and the different group homes which I visited in Anchorage, and I understand the need for both. But I think you're going the wrong way if you're going to try to take away from one to cut the same pie so you get a bigger slice. The answer is to take care of everybody, and if that requires more money, then we need to appropriate more money and maybe get it from some other place.
Yes, ma'am.
That's exactly what we had talked about on the council. The problem we have come up against when we talked about it is that we realize that, okay, you have to have the money every year appropriated, okay? At the same time, you have to increase monies for the new residential services. And what we find ourselves faced with is that, okay, we're virtually going to have to tell the legislature is that for several years, they're going to have to look at funds. Additional services that are going to be coming online. That's what we face. I mean, we had problems last year just getting funding for the programs we have now. We come up and we say, well, we need all this money for these other programs that don't even exist. How are you going to pay out?
Representative Bell,
thank you.
Two questions, if I might. I'm not sure who to really address them to, but I'll just assume that the right person will answer.
You can ask me in the hour.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm wondering if the thrust of the past couple of witnesses indicates that there is a basic long-term policy to get rid of these larger institutions, specifically Normandy. And from the nods of the head, I assume that that is your intent. So in the short term, what mechanisms do we have in place? In other words, are the personnel out there in a decentralized fashion to provide alternative service?
No. See, I think Senator Johnson hit it. The issue right now is moot, because all we can conceive of doing, even if you gave as much money to new programs as you could possibly give, it would take us long enough to build to get the facilities, we're able to train the people, and so on. It would take that long, in a sense, just to soak up, not Harvard people, you see, but the people who have been held up because there are no services available. During that time, you would have a revolving door process to Harvard, where the harder, more difficult to treat clients or careful clients would end up there. You know, in other words, you would have that process. But as the community service would get in place, in a sense, they would be able to handle in local group homes, developing more authentic environments and so on, even the more difficult.
So would your policy be to maintain the Harvard U institution as you develop these other facilities? Okay. And the thrust of your funding efforts would be to respond to these flood of correspondence by saying, yes, the facility for the moment is ongoing, is that right? Or to the best of your ability to pay. Okay, the other question I wanted to ask, are you getting the support from the municipalities that you serve? In other words, I'm finding that throughout the state, the municipalities are traditionally, at least in the context of the wild money days, focusing on capital construction. And a lot of the services which are provided in the operating budget do not get the same kind of lobbying effort that the physical facilities do. And consequently, I've found myself often recommending to city councils and what have you that if they're so concerned about this particular service or that particular service, that they expend the same sort of effort in that direction as they do with their capital projects. I'm wondering if you're getting the support you need from the municipalities here in Juneau to support this decentralization effort, which I would think would depend upon municipal aggressiveness if you want to get the money out to those communities. Or are you finding that that's
working? I think we're just beginning to commence to make the case to present those issues to the regions, the localities, and the provinces, and so on. And we'll probably tell you about our next meeting.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Just a comment. You know, the answer is, of course, more money, but I think that it behooves the legislature to start looking where the money is going for capital projects. And when I see a project that says $1 million, $2 million for a large meeting room for a municipality versus housing for handicap, I don't draw any analogy. A meeting room is so far down the line, but we don't do that. We fund these kinds of things, meeting rooms and all kinds of frivolous type of things. And I think maybe we need to get our priorities in line and start looking where the need is.
Representative Bell. Thank you. Yeah, I certainly agree, and I would think that some of the effort might come from you all to get the municipalities to direct conversation about a special ed and so forth?
If you want our opinion as a council, I don't think we can give it to council.
I guess I want your opinion in terms of improvements, if any, that you would recommend.
No, I think the answer is no. I think I'd say, just from looking at what happens, is that policies in education that drastically affect developmental disabilities are not coordinated. Education proceeds their way, and developmental disabilities proceed their way. Those two, really have to go together, because any money that's a special ed client in education during the school years is a residential potential for developmental disabilities as soon as they hit 21.
So do you have any recommendations then to those departments or to the legislature that might help us to unravel that problem?
I think we're beginning to work on that as a council. We're beginning to look at some of the issues that and are probably preparing for that.
Representative Linda has a question.
Well, I would ask a question to all of you, and that is, have you checked with your municipality and your representative to make sure that your capital requests are on the list? In the case of Anchorage, there are no human service capital projects on that list because technically they would not be owned by the municipality. And some of us who are committed to putting a very substantial sum on our capital money, whichever that turns out to, will be capital projects. Human services are very anxious because last year the governor vetoed everything that wasn't on the municipal list. You're not on the municipal list if you're from Anchorage. If that policy continues, all the money that I put in and the other representatives who really care about this put in will be vetoed and you will again come up dry. So you have an obligation along with us. We're working on this end, but you must make sure your mayor, whoever it is, puts your projects up as acceptable. Because if not on the list, they're not going to be acceptable and they'll be redlined. Get your money about how deserved it is.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Representative Copeland and then Senator Fisher.
As an illustration of that, in the priority at the beginning of last year, the Fairbank community, there were two priorities on the list, both of which got on in the budget at one point. And then we had a $3.5 million alcoholism center and a $4.75 million parking garage. But when push came to shove, it was the alcoholism center that fell out from the parking garage and stayed in.
Senator Fisher.
I'm just going along, Mr. Chairman, with Representative Lindauer. So you folks are aware, the municipality committed with their budget for capital projects, and I think it was around $180 million this year. So, and you're not on that list. So that's what it's on.
I might add the reason I was late. I was just on the phone again to Tyler Jones, insisting that they put on money improvements in a park for the handicapped, $100,000. I want to blast the money in there. We're arguing about whether it should be in.
You've done your homework. I just think maybe I should say it once more and add to the rest of the members here that I'm seeing this as at least too, that we're just not seeing these projects reflected on those capital projects. And often what can be done with $20,000 in the youth center can be far in excess of what can be achieved in $200,000, $300,000, or $400,000, or $500,000 in certain other types of municipal projects. Recreation projects are a case in point where they're directly related to alcoholism prevention or, in this case, working with the developmentally disabled. Unless the municipality makes the request and cites that relationship, it's just another recreation project that's subject to veto. But if you can demonstrate that the health and safety, or the health in this case, relevance, you've got something going. So without meaning to be any more redundant, if each of you can influence those municipalities from which you come to participate actively, I think you gain more than by almost any other single step. Are there any further questions?
Can I testify as well?
Yes, briefly.
Okay. My name is Belle Blue, legal name Betty Grip. I'm here as the parent of a gifted and talented child who is extremely intelligent and artistic and whose needs are not being met by either the school district or the state program. I would like to express my dissatisfaction with putting the gifted and talented and the handicapped in the same program, because the needs of the handicapped are so visible and so pressing that the needs of the gifted and talented often get overlooked. By comparison, the gifted and talented have everything going for them, which in fact they do. However, if we could channel a few more state funds into
encouraging and developing the talents that those very bright children have, it's possible that they might lead to a solution of preventing handicaps. They might go into medicine, genetics, something that could get at the real root of the problem, which is the cause of handicaps. So I think that we might consider dividing these groups of children into two separate groups. It's obvious that the gifted and talented do get overlooked simply if you, or do get a smaller share of the attention just in this conference this afternoon, 10 or 15 minutes. And the example of the gifted education person in the Department of Education, starting out as full-time and ending up only one-third time gifted and talented, instead of full-time and two-thirds time on special education. I think that the vast difference between the two groups warrants dividing them into separate categories and dealing with them as totally separate problems, because their needs are so different, their abilities are so different. And I'm not in any way opposed to a handicap. I think that's a very great obligation of the state, and I think that everything that has been said here this afternoon is absolutely true and is absolutely needed. However, I am saying that by lumping these two categories of people together, we are perhaps depriving society of some of the benefits of the education of the people who do in fact have the minds that might solve the problems we are facing.
Thank you. I want to thank everybody for attending today. I think